The following program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. At Whole Foods Market, we offer premium products without premium prices. Our everyday value items are free of artificial preservatives, colors, flavors, sweeteners, and hydrogenated fats. Priced competitively to average supermarket prices, the 365 Everyday Value brand offers food that meets our strict quality standards. Compare our peanut butter, canned beans, and cereals to the other guys. You'll see what we're talking about. Visit one of our six Manhattan stores in Tribeca, Bowery, Union Square, Chelsea, Columbus Circle, or the Upper West Side. Open 7 days a week, 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. For more information, visit www.wholefoodsmarket.com.
Welcome to Unfiltered. I'm your host, Brian DeMarco, with your co-host, the lovely and talented Aaron Fitzpatrick. Say hello, Aaron. Oh, Aaron's having technical difficulties. I wish
listeners could see the laughing attack.
She's mesmerized by my snarkiness. But anyway, we're here live at Roberta's today. It's a beautiful day in Crooklyn, and we've got our co-host Aaron with our guest.
I'm back.
She's back.
Just had a little laughing fit for a moment because our guest today is just one with Rasta, so he's
Ja for
was
sure.
Ja, yeah, yep. He was rocking out with the King Tubby intro. So
yeah. Well,
but before we introduce him, thank you to our producer Jack Inslee and
our
May
sponsor
10th.
Today, Whole Foods. Thank you,
yep.
Whole Foods.
Mm-hmm. And a little week in wine sort of touch upon before we start today's show.
Yeah, a lot going on, huh?
You had just got back from Germany, so I thought it was apropos to mention that some news came out today that it's the worst frost that they've had for the past 30 years, and temperatures have dipped really low. So they're really worried about the 2011 crop, so I'm not sure whether or not you had any sort of thoughts upon that after your travels there. What were you doing there?
Well, I was drinking a lot of Riesling.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. I mean, Germany right now, when I was there, the weather was fabulous, quite honestly. At night, it did chill down quite a bit. And their biggest complaint was a lack of rain. And so the interesting part for me was that the acidities of the wine that we tasted out of barrel and then the 2010 vintage was all pretty straight, pretty linear. And the stuff that they were looking at harvesting, there was some damage, and there was some hail damage. And I guess the frost at night does take a beating.
Mm-hmm.
What did they say they were going to lose in crop?
Potentially, 25% of the crop. So it's not necessarily known quite yet, but just something to be wary of. But this is in certain regions. This is Pfalz, Rheinhessen, that the temperatures dropped pretty low. And you were in the Mosel, yeah?
Well, I was in the Rheingau as well. And the Rheinhessen, we drove through and stopped and saw a few wineries. But, it's such a diverse landscape. You know, everyone thinks German wines are predominantly sweet wines, at least in the U.S., when in Germany, most wines are dry, and the German population probably drinks 95% of the wines they're drinking are either dry white or red, and the sweet wines are the export wines. So it's pretty interesting to note that there's a lot of misconceptions on German wines.
Yeah. Well, there's a tasting on Thursday as well, the German wine annual tasting.
Let's give a shout out. It's going to be at the Tribeca rooftop on Thursday.
360 degrees on De Bros Street.
Yes, and our good friend Bruce Schneider is hosting that, and we'll put it on the website today for all you German aficionados and wine fans.
Yep.
But why don't you do the pleasure and introduce our guest?
Sure.
Today.
Well, we have a returning guest today, actually, who was one of the first visitors of the network on At the Root of It, and welcoming him back. It's Brian Smith.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me back.
Thank you for coming again.
Big shout out to Brian.
Yeah.
Big shout out.
Big shouts.
It was an honor the first time. And now I am once again.
Yeah, well, you must have done something right, or else we're just desperate for guests.
Well, Brian has a whole new project underway. So where we talked about digital wine maps and, you know, the fancy wine bar that he was running in Time Warner Center, which was Clo, he was already sort of working on this project during that time and then has since gone full throttle with it. So if you could introduce it for our listeners, that'd be great.
Sure, sure, I'd love to. The wine project is called Loca Linda, which is Loca is crazy and Linda is beautiful. Also, my mom's name is Linda, so I got to give her a shout out.
Oh, my mom's name is Linda, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'll give her a shout out as well.
Shout out to Linda's all over. Lindas.
I actually Googled how many Lindas there were in the world.
And
there were like 1.1 million in the world. So shout out to all the Lindas out there.
Well, that's a lot of free time at night.
Yeah. Well, I've Googled some other statistics that I'll bring up later in the show as well.
That's incredible. That's incredible. Yeah, I would love that. I mean, honestly, those kind of random facts, you know, keep us going. It's a fodder for this show.
If you were about to say that your mom's name was beautiful too, that was going to be cool.
That's like, her middle name.
That's her middle name.
But at any rate, basically, I went down to Argentina 4 years ago and. I'd been a sommelier for a number of years and had always wanted to do something on the other side. Never knew how, where, when.
Had you ever done a harvest before?
Believe it or not, I had not done a harvest before. You know, it's for a sommelier or a buyer or anyone, there are just huge barriers to entry to get into the winemaking side and the supply side. You know, I went to Argentina not necessarily with the goal of doing this on my first trip, but I absolutely fell in love with the place, the natural resources in terms of older vines, great climate, and I just fell in love with the Argentina in general.
Yeah,
and
it's sort easy of to do it, that there.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And I made a, you know, kind of a commitment to give it a shot, and if I was going to do it, that was sort of my time to give it a shot, and that's what I did.
Cool.
Well, let me ask you, what is giving it a shot mean? Like, tell me the steps you took and how you got your first vintage to market. I mean, and tell us about the project a bit.
Well, it's an interesting, I mean, it's not without any pitfalls. But really, the first step was booking my second trip down there to figure out what was really going on. I mean, you're in a foreign country, you've got, you know, currencies, inflation, you've got language barriers, you've got all these different things. So really, the first goal was just to really dig in and find grape sources that I liked, people that shared similar philosophies as I do in terms of winemaking, and really just kind of like dig in. And it took a few trips before I really had any idea of what the landscape truly looked like down there. But that was one of the most exciting times, was kind of like seeing what's behind door number four,
sure,
and then what's behind
all of that,
door
yeah.
number five, and kind of slowly piecing them together through, you know, building relationships, basically.
I remember that actually you and I had talked about Argentina maybe 2 years ago when you were running Clo, the wine bar in Time Warner Center, and you were fascinated by the idea of bringing wines to market, and were kind of you know, you had the palate and you had, I think, all the vision. It just, some of the logistics probably, as they do many, befuddle us. And it becomes a project that is born out of love, but then comes to be this logistical and financial nightmare if you don't do it right.
Right.
Absolutely. I just shook when you said logistics.
But I've heard Argentina, for starters, is not an easy place to do business. So especially when you're looking at exporting something, there's all those other layers on top.
It is really challenging. And I've been fortunate enough to have a lot of friends who were able to kind of help me along the way and push me over small mountains and speed bumps, but incredibly challenging. I mean, you know, from there's the whole brand, the whole idea of like doing this wine crazy beautiful is like, it's beautiful in Argentina and I'm like crazy enough to try this.
And
it's sort of like this free form, doing a lot of things wrong but learning really quickly. I mean, from you know, from doing things within the country, like purchasing bottles, which you would think like winemaking is like, you know, that's like one of the most difficult things. But the first liter bottles that I purchased were screw caps, and we bought a pallet of them, and we were all ready to bottle. And It turns out I had purchased olive oil bottles.
Of course you did.
Of course, right?
And the guy who sold it to you.
Head scratcher.
Right, exactly.
Head scratcher. But we kind of like turned that into a positive in that the way I sell these liter bottles is in a 9-bottle box, which is, again, really goofy and kind of incorrect if you look at how people are supposed to do things.
Right.
But the reasoning behind that was sort of, by the time I went through this bottle debacle, I really needed to ship my 700 cases and get them in the States and start selling something.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so the box guys were like, we got a 9-bottle box that we could use, or it'll take 45 days for a 12-bottle box. Knowing that 45 days was going to be like 120.
Well, 45 days in Argentina is 6 months.
Exactly. So, yeah. It really is. Really. I mean, it's close to six months. Right.
So,
did you roll out with the Torontes first or the Malbec?
The Torontes, we did the 08 vintage of Malbec. So that was the first vintage, and the 09 vintage of Torontes. So now what we're going to taste today is the 09 Malbec and 2010 Torontes.
Okay.
Yeah,
cool. But we'll do that after the break.
Yes, I just got a little curious about which one rolled into the the U.S. shores first.
Initially, actually, my idea was to do. I was really passionate about the Torontes grape, just because I love aromatic whites, and it's something that sort of resonated with me, and I thought there was potential to really focus on that grape varietal. But as I got down there and was looking around, I fell in love with some a Malbec vineyard and some sources down there too, and so that's why I ended up doing both, probably saved my life.
Brian, being the super som that you are, tell me what you think. I mean, Torontes is the indigenous white, and the probably the flagship for Argentina. Do you compare it to, say, a California Chardonnay in terms of like the representation of a region, or do you think that Argentina is also doing great Chardonnay, great Sauvignon Blanc, or should they just stick to their knitting and do Torontes, or is there enough planted?
Argentina's done so well with taking an otherwise obscure grape varietal like Malbec and really creating a unique style and an image and a perception of quality and value around that. And so I think that whereas Malbec was a blending grape and you found it in small amounts in Cahors and other places, not nearly to the scale of what you see commercially in Argentina, I think that Torontes is, while stylistically it still needs to figure itself out, and there are a lot of varying styles in the market, which we can talk about, it's got a similar sort of potential. Maybe not on the scale of Malbec, but certainly it's an interesting wine and something that's very unique to Argentina.
Well, great. I mean, I think this is something we're looking forward to tasting. Let me ask you one other question about the Malbec. Are you also doing that in a liter bottle?
Yes.
How has that been received?
It's been received well. It's a funny thing. I walk in with a 9-bottle case, which throws everyone's math off. They're like, I actually have to get the calculator for this. So I walk in with a 9-bottle case and two wines in liters, which is you see it out there for Gruners, and I've seen a couple Australian wines, but really it's not entirely a popular format. And so some people are like, genius, I love it, man, this is great. Like, I think it's just such a great idea.
So
I
want to pour it by the glass. Where can we find this wine? Who are those people?
We're
here in New York for our listeners.
Here in New York. One of my first account in my home neighborhood of Fort Greene, Brooklyn, was the Green Grape.
Woo woo!
So they've been incredibly supportive. Brooklyn Wine Exchange, 67 Wines, Frankly Wines, I think, has it now.
Christy Frank, she'll try anything.
Yeah.
Once,
right. Yeah. I think she still has some. She's just waiting to kick it out.
No, she's a good lady. She's a good lady.
I think, we've got some great glass pours, too. We're like a Patroon.
Yeah, I'm saying for a glass, it's
Abe and Arthur's.
Yeah.
Nice. The Meatpacking District poured this. We've got some cool, it's been well received by people that sort of handle it with care, which is the biggest thing with something.
So your
like
olive oil bottles, which you originally bought, I mean, what size were those? I mean,
they were liters, but they were cap.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you had always intended upon doing a liter bottle.
I had always wanted to do a liter bottle.
Okay.
And the idea is, it's kind of a two-pronged idea. The first is 750s are too small, as beverage specialists in this room can attest. 750 goes like that. with a few people. So they're too small. The other thing I wanted to do is, if I was going to do a wine, you kind of have the, like, what do you want to do? Do you want to do super high-end, super boutique, one barrel? Or do you want to do something that is, like, approachable and kind of fun? And my philosophy as a sommelier is always to make anything, no matter how esoteric, sort of approachable and fun, but with a level of sophistication.
Yep.
So with the Leader, we're able to do some really cool things in the vineyard and also in the winery. But just by the nature of the format, it almost, like, throws things off a little bit and it becomes more approachable. And that was another reason.
Okay.
So not, this is not going to be the Carlo Rossi here, jug wine.
You know. You tasted it? It doesn't taste anything like that.
I hope not.
No, we're getting there. We're going to go there in a second.
Those are 5-liter. And now that I've done the liter, I'm kind of like, well, what can we do? You know, like a 3-liter
bottle. Right.
I want to do some large format.
Push it forward.
Yeah, yeah.
The labeling and the the packaging branding is also really sharp. So I think that when you talk about hitting those two different ideas that you want to play with and make it approachable but still keep it sophisticated, it certainly gives that off.
Thank you.
By just looking at it. Yeah.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
Sure.
I can only see the back label, so I'm just, you know, I'm, oh, wow.
Yeah. She's pretty.
She's crazy.
So, yeah, so in Argentina, it's a compliment that I heard on my first trip there. Someone was introducing me to who is now a woman who is now a really good friend of mine, and they said, oh, you have to meet her, es una loca linda. And I was like, crazy? Beautiful? That sounds interesting. What exactly is that?
Are you giving someone copyright right now? Or
what's that?
You got copyright infringement going on, or are you giving a shout-out to...
That's another shout-out. I'm probably going to give it a couple more shout-outs.
Excellent.
That's another shout-out.
Well, let's wrap up for our break here, and then when we get back, we will taste some wine on air with our host, Aaron Fitzpatrick, and our guest, Mr. Brian Smith.
Service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Tuesday at noon, Dave Arnold, the author of CookingIssues.com, will discuss new and innovative techniques, equipment, and ingredients. Call in with your own questions to see if Dave and the crew can solve your cooking issues. Again, that's Tuesdays at noon on the Heritage Radio Network.
Yeah, you're gonna do some pouring and stuff.
Should I pour now?
No,
we can pour now. You are listening to Unfiltered on the Heritage Radio Network. Thanks for joining us today. And for our listeners, please feel free to call in with any questions for our guest, Brian Smith of Loca Linda, at 718-497-2128. So we're going to move into the second part of today's program with a little on-air tasting. Brian has brought the Loca Linda Torrentes from La Rioja and Malbec from Mendoza. So we're going to talk a bit about the differences in the regions in Argentina. You hear a lot about Mendoza.
Nice.
Yeah, pop, pop.
The on-air pop.
But we hear so much about Mendoza, but not so much about the other wine producing regions there. So it'd be cool to hear a bit about where Torrontes thrives and La Salta and, you know, the different appellations there that have microclimates.
Yeah, I mean, Brian, we were, you know, in our past discussions and also, you know, obviously tasting, you know, being in the wine trenches with you, I see, you know, people talking about the Torrontes from Salta having a different expression of minerality, and then you see, you know, sort of flagons of, you know, Torrontes from Malbec, and then yours is from La Rioja. So can you tell us the differences between those regions and how the stylistically they sort of interplay, or are they their own unique terroir?
Absolutely. I mean, you've got, you know, we were just talking about that in the break, how there are such varying styles within the category. And it's not like there's a huge amount of Torrontes coming into the United States market, although it is growing at a faster rate than Malbec. But you've got very different styles. You've got three different primary regions, really, which is Mendoza, La Rioja, and Salta in the north, as you mentioned. And you've also got some different clones of the grape, which produce different styles, and they're grown in each region. So what we work with is the Riojana clone, which I think is the best, obviously. And
explain that.
Well, it tends to throw off pretty aromatics, but it also gives a lot of weight on the palate, and it's just the versions to me tend to have more texture, more structure, and more balance.
There's a lot of viscosity to this wine.
There's a lot of viscosity. Yeah, this, I mean, to me, this is different. Like I said, varying styles, very different than a lot of Torrontes that's out there in the far north in Salta. You've got, you know, possibly, I believe they're the most high altitude or the highest altitude vineyards in the world. So very, you know, very crisp, very clean wines, high aromatics, and a lot of tension in them. South of us in Mendoza, you know, there are some good versions, but on the whole, they tend to be, they don't have this weight. This is real characteristic of this clone in this region. And this vineyard is pretty cool. It's old. It's a average age of 50-year-old Torrontes vines. So Torrontes as a grape has been grown and consumed within Argentina for a very long time, but it's not until maybe 10 or 15 years ago that you really had any winemakers sort of focusing on these old vines to create higher quality wines.
Well, let me interrupt for one sec. You talked about old vines, and some of the, are some of the oldest vines the 50-year-old vines, or are there some even older?
For Torrontes, I'm not sure. Definitely for Malbec, you see a lot of,
of course,
a lot of older vines. I haven't seen, I haven't really been to any vineyards where I've seen older vines, but I'm sure they're there.
And let me ask you then: do you know the genealogy of Torrontes? I mean, a lot of people talk about, you know, the clones of Pinot Noir and the clones of, you know, and what Blaufränkisch is, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, let me ask you: what Torrontes was, you know, when people brought Malbec to Argentina? It's obviously a cohort cutting. What is Torrontes? Is it really an indigenous field grape, or is it something that may have been Franciscan monked over there?
Well, they think it's, I mean, what I've heard a lot of people say, and it's kind of funny because no one has a real answer. They haven't really
done. That's my question.
They haven't really, like, figured this one out yet. But typically, you know, people think that it's of Spanish origin,
mm-hmm.
You know, from northeast Spain. And I think with this version where you get some of that oily quality on the texture kind of hints at that as well.
Because some of my Gallego, my friends in, you know,
northern Spain.
Right. You know, we do a lot of business up there. They claim credit for having been the people who planted that grape. And they think it's a cross between, you know, Albariño and maybe some sort of Gadeo. But who knows?
But that's interesting because I think it has this particular one that you've brought today, yours, is it has that acidity that Albariño can bring, you know,
right.
That melon characteristic. And then it also has that richness, the Gadeo, you know, that honeyed notes, that flowery characteristic, which is really well balanced. Yeah.
See, Brian, this isn't just, you're just not a good looking show. We actually know something
right
over here.
I wish the audience could see how good it looks in here right now.
It's amazing how good it looks.
It's like a double whammy.
I mean,
and Jack got new plants, so there's nice five green lush. I don't know. What is it? Cilantro? We got some parsley, cilantro in here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll take credit for that.
Thank you, Jack.
Nice. And then, and you see our waterfall. You like that, right?
Yeah, it's really come together since the last time I've been here. It's
impressive. It's bringing you up to those falls in Argentina, the Igaxu.
I'm going to bring a rug because, you know, the rug used to pull this place together, but, you know, it got stolen. So I'm going to have to, you know.
That'll happen.
I'm gonna have to Lebowski that thing and find it.
But yeah, on the Torontes, I think you hit on some good points. It's got it's got the personalities of a lot of different grape varietals, mm-hmm. and to me, that's what made it attractive. It's also what makes it a real challenge to create the right style. I think.
So explain the region that this wine comes from and why you chose it.
This is from Famatina Valley, just outside of a little town called Chilecito. It's right on the base of the Andes.
Chilecito.
Right on the base of the Andes, like most of the vineyard land in Argentina. It's flood irrigated. You have very little rainwater. It's sort of sandy alluvial soil, and it's at about 1,000. This vineyard's at about 1,000 meters, and you'll find that with Malbec and with a lot of the grape varietals in Argentina, altitude and elevation plays a huge role. You know, it's essentially a high desert there, so ripening grapes is not a huge issue. It's really getting the balance and the acidity and the phenolic development to go along with that. And so when you have higher altitudes, you've got the big shifts in temperature that kind of speed up the development during the day and then slow it down at night.
Well, I think in many parts of the world that cool nights and having some humidity at night is the key to great winemaking in the vineyard. You know,
yeah.
Most people say wine is made in the vineyard, and if it's just bloody hot all day and hot at night, you're not getting that acidity, and the grapes don't have a chance, or the plant doesn't have a chance to relax and you know, reset itself. Wow, this is really nice Torontes, I have to admit.
Yeah, it's very tasty.
It's got some waxiness to it, and there's some weird notes on the back of it that are like spicy, and I think it's like an Asian food perfect match.
Yeah, yeah, it's great for anything that's got that sweet sour component, or anything that's got a little heat to it. And obviously, if you bring in some sort of fruit component, it's pretty too.
I think this is going with a pepperoni pizza from Roberta's later.
Roberta's, yeah.
Did we put an order in yet?
But all right, so now you've just poured us the Malbec. What vintage is this?
This is 09, 09 Malbec. So this is, you know, when I wanted to work with Malbec, again, going back to this sort of overarching idea that, you know, it's a high altitude desert there, lots of sunshine, plenty of sun, very dry, any moisture really is either flood irrigated or drip irrigated, so you can kind of control that. Everyone can get ripeness, or most people get some good level of ripeness. But what we wanted to do is, I like high acid whites and aromatic whites, and I like reds with acidity too.
Mm-hmm.
And so we wanted to try and make a wine and create a wine that had a little tension left in it. And it wasn't so over the top in terms of ripeness, and we didn't hit it with a huge amount of oak. But we tried to leave some tension in it and leave it a little bit lighter, if you will. And so,
well, after this, you know, I tell you, there's tension, but there's not the nervousness to it. It's not like, you know, it feels sort of, it's wound up, but not too tightly wound. And there's some good mid palate, and there's a medium finish to it. So I think it's really interesting.
Thank you.
What is this a retail shelf wine for? What can I buy this for?
This is from anywhere from like $16.99 to $19.99.
That's because it's in the liter format.
Yeah.
And then the Torontes is a bit more, yeah?
No, same.
Same price.
Same
okay,
price.
Cool.
Yeah.
Do people perceive a greater value in the format, meaning that they're getting more wine for their money? Or are the retailers pricing in the fact that it's a liter?
No, I think the retailers, I always wish they'd charge a little bit less, but that's not my business. but I think... It requires a hand sell in many ways, or I think it helps to have a hand sell, and a lot of the accounts like Brooklyn Wine Exchange and some of these other places where we are really are people that you know, operate that way. And once it's hand sold once, I feel like, you know, people really like the wine. That's when the sort of the idea that it's a leader kicks mm-hmm. in, and they've got a little bit more to share
with their friends. To date, what is the best seller?
Malbec.
Yeah. And just a quick question to go back to the corks. Just curious as to, like, if you're in your initial thought we're going to go with screw cap, and then now you've gone with cork, how has that sort of changed your, you know, perception in terms of the sellability of it?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to do screw caps because I thought it kind of made sense, but I'm actually pleased that I went with corks.
Okay.
I think it's, you know, at the price point I'm at, and I think with the quality of wines, I think it's, at least I hope the quality of the wines, I think it suits. And I'm kind of glad that I went with
cool.
It's interesting because I mean, if I would have probably done the white under screw cap and the Malbec under cork, but that's a perfect world. And
yeah.
I imagine it was easier on your bottling line to buy, you know, enough bottles, because you seem to have the same bottle for both wines.
Yes.
And so I'm sure logistically it made a lot more sense to buy one bottle for both.
Yeah.
There's that word, logistically. I mean, look, my first vintage was 720 cases total. So
that's a lot of wine, Brian.
Is it?
It's rather small in
it's
context.
Small. I mean, it's not gallon size.
It felt big, but it was enough risk.
It's still boutique.
For the first shot.
It's very still boutique.
But it's not. That's tiny production for Malbec. We'll just say
absolutely,
that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, so, it's a small container, right? You brought a small container.
Yeah.
Okay.
Barely filled.
And I wanted to speak a little bit. I know you've been exploring some ideas with how to get the general public and wine enthusiasts more behind Torontes as a great variety. So anything that you've been sort of championing at the moment with respect to it?
Yeah, definitely. I'm sort of, you know, summer is here. And to me, this is like the ultimate. Torontes is the ultimate summer wine. So
yeah.
Kind of kicking around this, like, summertime is Torontes time. Concept. Maybe nice. We'll make like a beer t-shirt that says that, Miller time. But I'm organizing right now with a bunch of friends and colleagues an online virtual tasting where we're going to all pop corks on some Torontes and kind of enjoy it
all across the country
nice. And we're going to get some people to kind of chat it up and also some people to support it in their restaurants and retail stores and just kind of grow the awareness for this grape, because I think it can be pretty interesting.
Absolutely, and that's not yet determined with respect to a date.
I'm working on a date. This
okay.
is my first
okay.
time doing
we'll make sure
anything
to include
like
us.
This.
Yeah,
I will, absolutely. Well, I appreciate the support.
Brian, I want to give a shout out to Wines of Argentina. You know, they're having a show coming up soon. I was wondering, are you going to be at that show?
I will be at the show. I'm not pouring at the show, but I'll be there.
Do you know when the date is again?
I believe there is a tasting for the trade on Friday, this coming Friday, and it's in, I don't know the address, but it's in Midtown in a loft there.
I will
from 2 to 6.
I will find that out, and we will put it on our site for our listeners. So if you're interested in Wines of Argentina, and specifically Torontes or Malbec, you can taste those on Friday at the Wines of Argentina show here in New York City. And let's do one last on-air tasting here with this Malbec, and I want Mr. Smith's tasting notes for a parting shot.
Well, it's not supposed to taste like that. No, just kidding.
This is live, Brian.
Corks
this is
bitch.
Live radio. Yeah. Come on, brother.
No, I'm just kidding. You know, to me, this is from the Uco Valley, from Tupungato, and a sub-region within there called Vista Flores. And typically in this area, classic aroma is violets. But to me, it's a lot of like some dark cherry fruit, berry fruit, violets. And then we don't use a huge amount of oak. Really, only 30% of the wine sees any time in oak. And it's for a very short time, just to sort of integrate the palate. The other thing that I didn't mention is I blend in this vintage, I blended in 10% Cabernet Sauvignon from an adjacent parcel. And I usually like to play with a little Cabernet Sauvignon.
Is that to pop up the fruit or?
Yeah, to me, it really organizes Malbec. Malbec can be kind of, sometimes I don't want to say sloppy, but it can be sort of round. And to me, the Cab really brings focus to it. It lifts the aromatics and it gives it good structure. And it kind of changes the wine. But at this level, we try and just kind of like clean it up. And I really like what it brings to the wine.
So you put a skirt on her and put some makeup on it.
Dress
it's nice.
Yeah, dress it up.
I like that.
Yeah, a little perfume.
Sometimes a sloppy wine's fun too, though, right?
A little violet perfume there. Yeah. Okay, you're cut off now.
Next.
Well, I think it's nice. It has a medium body, sort of easy drinkability to it. Still got that grip, but the nice dark fruit. So, again, for a liter bottle to be a crowd pleaser, this is certainly, you know, well chosen.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, thank you, Brian. This has been fabulous, and thank you for sharing your great wines with us.
It's my pleasure.
Yep. Thanks again for coming on. Here. Yep. Hopefully, we'll have you back for a third time at some point soon.
I'll come up with something.
Come up with something. Yeah. And for our listeners, again, you can find Loca Linda at the Green Grape.
And Brooklyn Wine Exchange.
And Brooklyn Wine Exchange. Yeah.
Slope Cellars.
Yeah, that'll do for now.
That'll do.
www.localinda.com.
Check us out next Tuesday, 4 o'clock.
Praise God.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. And now here's some behind-the-scenes food news with Katie Kiefer.
Guess what? Food prices will likely continue to rise given the fact that corn planting is lagging way behind last year. According to Drover's Cattle Network, planting is down 53%, which will undoubtedly put more of a squeeze on livestock farmers, especially pork and chicken farmers, because after all, they're the ones who use more corn than anybody else in terms of livestock production. Here's a quote from the Drover's Cattle Network. 13% of the corn in the top 18 producing states has been planted, according to the USDA's Crop Progress Report, which was released on May 2nd. Although it is a 4% improvement from last week, nationally, the 2011 corn planting is 27% behind the five-year average and 53% behind 2010's progress, and this is no doubt likely to bad weather, drought conditions in various places, and more rain in others. Who knows? But whatever it is, look to see your grocery bills rising over the next few months. This is Katie Kiefer for Behind the Scenes Food News.
Did you know we have a beer show? Check out a small clip from Beer Sessions Radio.
All right, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43, and I'm here with Ray Dieter from the DBA Bars.
Hey, Jim.
Ray, this is a fun show. We're drinking Belgian beer. We're drinking Ichtigum, hanging out with the guys from 124 Rabbit Club. And we got Don and Wendy from Van Berg and the Wolf. Well, let's go back a little bit to kind of build your pedigree. So the two of your top brands that we love and that you have now, Scaldis and Saison DuPont.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell us how you met those guys, how you started working with them.
Well, Saison DuPont was really... that was.
If you want to hear more, head over to heritageradionetwork.com where new episodes of Beer Sessions are posted every week in our archive. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. The following is a message from Heritage Foods USA. In the next few weeks, Heritage Foods USA will be offering an interesting variety of amazing products, ranging from top-quality seafood to their famous pork cuts. At the end of May, the Heritage team will go up to Maine to harvest fresh lobster with sustainable lobstermen. These delicious lobster are a perfect way to kick off the summer season. In the pork department, Heritage Foods USA will offer the maple-cured smoked boneless Heritage ham at an unbeatable price. This offer won't last long, so get them while you can. Place your order today at heritagefoodsusa.com or call 718-389-0985. That's 718-389-0985 to place your order with Andrea or Ashley. And don't forget to sign up for the email list and to check them on Facebook and Twitter to get in on their new products, deals, and offers from Heritage Foods USA.